We have a lot of material to cover today, but the good news is I'm teaching next week also, so if I don't finish today, I can figure out perhaps over the next few days how to incorporate that into next week. Today we're going to be looking at the allocation of the lands in the Transjordan, which is the east side of the Jordan River. We'll be looking at Joshua chapter 13, but because we need a little background on this, I want to start by looking at a few verses in the 32nd chapter of Numbers. This will give us some context for today's lesson. So if you want to follow along, we're looking at Numbers chapter 32. I'll be reading initially the first five verses. Now the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad had an exceedingly large number of livestock. So when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that it was indeed a place suitable for livestock, the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben came and spoke to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the leaders of the congregation, saying, Ataroth, Divon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Eleale, and Sibam, Nebo, and Beon, the land which the Lord conquered before the congregation of Israel, is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. They said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan. So here we have the tribes of Reuben and Gad. As their livelihood, they have a lot of sheep, they have a lot of cattle. They raise livestock. So Israel is currently on the east side of the Jordan River, and before they crossed into the land of Canaan, these two tribes came to Moses and they asked for an inheritance on the east side of Jordan, which is known as Transjordan. Transjordan simply means across the Jordan, and it's talking about the eastern side of the Jordan River. They saw that this was good for their cattle and their sheep, and so they wanted their possession of land to be over there. Now, look at verse 6. But Moses said to the sons of Gad, to the sons of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit over here? Now why are you discouraging the sons of Israel from crossing over into the land which the Lord has given to them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them to Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol, they saw the land, they discouraged the sons of Israel, so that they did not go into the land which the Lord had given them. So the Lord's anger burned that day, and he swore, saying, none of the men who came up from Egypt, from 20 years old and upward, shall see the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, for they did not follow me fully, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have followed the Lord fully. So in response to this request, Moses pointed out that it wouldn't be fair for the Reubenites and the Gadites to settle in lands that are already conquered while the other tribes have to go fight for their inheritances. So they come to an agreement. An agreement was made to address this inequity in their request. Skip down to verse 16. Then they came near to him, to Moses, and said, we will build here sheepfolds for our livestock and cities for our little ones. But we ourselves will be armed and ready to go before the sons of Israel until we have brought them to their place, while our little ones live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance. So these two tribes agreed to go with their brothers into Canaan and to fight alongside them, and only when all of the Israelites were given their inheritance would the Reubenites and the Gadites cross back over to the east side of the Jordan. And then I want to look at verse 33 of this same chapter. So Moses gave to them, to the sons of Gad, and to the sons of Reuben, and to the half-tribe of Joseph's son Manasseh, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, the king of Bashan, the land with the cities and with their territories, the cities surrounding the land. And then finally, in the 22nd chapter of Joshua, verse 7, we read now, the one half tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given a possession in Bashan, but to the other half, Joshua gave a possession among their brothers westward beyond the Jordan. So the tribe of Manasseh is sort of unique. As we see from these two verses, they also had a possession in Transjordan, but they're referred to many times as the half tribe of Manasseh, and that's because half of their allocation was in the east, and the other half was on the western side of the Jordan River. So Manasseh was split with half on the east and half on the west. So I wanted to take a minute this morning and just go through some of these texts, verses and numbers, because it'll help us understand more fully and clearly how the land allocations occur in the balance of this chapter. This chapter is one of the reasons that many people never read the Old Testament. Because it's one of those chapters that's replete with numerous difficult-to-pronounce place names. My wife, oh, you should see the look I'm getting. My wife and my daughter can hear a tongue twister once, and then they can repeat it flawlessly 100 times in a row without making a mistake. I can study the same tongue twister all afternoon, and I still can't say it once. There's something about a tongue twister that's related to estrogen. I'm not sure what it is. But women can master the art of the tongue twister, whereas men can not read one aloud after an hour's practice. Now, I've done a lot of research on this, and if I'm not mistaken, my wife and daughter are what linguists call rubber baby buggy bumper finger fumbler linguisticians. See, I thought about asking my wife to read today's text, but I know better than that. So I'm going to do my best to stumble through a very difficult-to-read chapter, and we're going to start with the first seven verses. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years when the Lord said to him, "You're old and advanced in years." And very much of the land remains to be possessed. This is the land that remains. All the regions of the Philistines and all those of the Geshurites from the Sheor, which is on the east side of Egypt, even as far as the border of Ekron to the north. Then he makes an editorial statement here. He said it's counted as Canaanite. The five lords of the Philistines, the Gazite, the Ashdodite, the Ashkelonite, the Gittite, the Ekronite, and the Avite. To the south, all the land of the Canaanite and Meara that belongs to the Sidonians as far as Aphek, to the border of the Amorite, and the land of the Gibelite, and all of Lebanon toward the east from Baal-Gad below Mount Hermon as far as Lebo Hamath. All the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon as far as Misrephoth Mayim, all the Sidonians, I'll drive them out from before you, before the sons of Israel. Only allot it to Israel for an inheritance, for I have commanded you. Now, therefore, apportion this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and half-tribe of Manasseh. So, I want to begin today with a question. What does the Bible have to say about finishing what you've started? Well, it actually has quite a lot to say about the importance of seeing a work through to completion. In Ecclesiastes, which is a book written to impart wisdom to the reader, we read, "Better is the end of a thing than its beginning." Early in the book of Genesis, Moses writes, "God saw all that he had made, and it was exceedingly good." Had made presumes completion. Then Genesis goes on to say, "The heavens and the earth were finished, and all their hosts. On the seventh day, God finished his work. Clearly, Jesus agreed with Ecclesiastes in Genesis because he said, he actually summed up his ministry by saying, my food, that is what sustains me, is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. I want you to notice he says to do and to finish. So keep that in mind as we go through this chapter. No one possessing a modicum of sanity likes war. A sane nation doesn't celebrate the beginning of a war, but every nation celebrates the end of a war, and Israel was no exception. Israel was very tired of war. This chapter, chapter 13, moves us into the second part of the book of Joshua. In one sense, the conquest is presented in this book essentially as complete. If you were to look at Joshua chapter 11, verse 23, it reads, so Joshua took the whole of the land. And you'll remember we talked about the conquest coming into the central part of Canaan, then he took the south, and then he took the north. So the text says he took the whole of the land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. But there's a parallel emphasis that runs alongside this that depicts a task yet undone and a land yet to be occupied and possessed. So the work of the conquest is incomplete. And if we look ahead just a bit, we're going to see this clearly. In chapter 15, verse 63, we read, now as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah could not drive them out. So the Jebusites lived with the sons of Judah in Jerusalem until this day. And then in Joshua chapter 17, verse 12, but the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of these cities because the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. With respect to the conquest, throughout the Old Testament, there's a tension between what has been accomplished and what remains to be done. Israel has not finished her work. And the promised land remains just that, a promise, because the complete fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant awaits the second coming of Jesus Christ. And Israel will not see the complete fulfillment of the covenant until, as Zechariah says, they look on him whom they have pierced. This is when the Abrahamic covenant will be fulfilled, when the national conversion of Israel will take place at the second coming of Jesus Christ. The tension between what is fulfilled, what's been accomplished, and what remains to be done has a purpose, because it shows us that the Old Testament is not an end unto itself. Something better awaits the sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. As you read the Bible, it's almost as though the New Testament is hidden as a mystery in the Old Testament. But the Old Testament is revealed fully in the New Testament. Verse 1 begins with a statement about Joshua. He says, now Joshua was old and advanced in age. Likely, he was around 75 to 85 years old at this time. We don't know exactly, but that's probably pretty close. And I think we need to stop and think about this for a moment, because the phrase is repeated. Joshua's age is mentioned twice. And then in between those two mentions, like a book between bookends, his responsibility to continue serving God is mentioned. It strikes me as significant and something we can't fail to notice, that the opening verse reads, Joshua was advanced in years, and very much of the land remains to be possessed. Israel was tired of war, but the war wasn't over. God had entrusted Moses to lead Israel during the Exodus and the wilderness period. Then God entrusted Joshua with the responsibility of leading Israel in the conquest period, a time that was at least equally taxing as the time in the wilderness and in a lot of ways, probably more so. And now God is assigning to Joshua, a man advanced in age, the responsibility of allotting the land to the tribes of Israel. Not an easy task. And here's the point. If you're alive, you're not too old to serve the Lord. The specific things you may be able to do may not involve the same level of physical activity you expended in the past. In fact, there are cases where a ministry may be limited to praying for the younger people who are doing the things you used to do. But the Lord honors your service, whatever the task, whatever your age. And Joshua accepted the specific responsibility that God had laid before him. I'll even go so far as to say, when we get older, we find we are the recipients of care rather than the givers of care. And when every fiber of our being feels that that's wrong because it's a complete reversal from everything we've known, stop and think. God may be giving someone else the great opportunity to serve him by serving you. I came to the realization of this during the last year of my dad's life, and this is how I viewed the increased responsibility that fell to us. He was my mother's caregiver for most of her life. My mother had polio and was in a wheelchair. For 63 years of their marriage, my dad took care of her. And then she passed away. And suddenly my dad was my responsibility. So I had to think a lot about this kind of thing. I think he understood, but he didn't like it. And I understood that. Well, I've digressed a bit. The extent described in Scripture of the conquest as being accomplished is only a partial thing. Now it's time for the conquered lands to be distributed to the tribes of Israel. The nature of these allotments divides the chapter into two parts. Verses 1 through 13 record the distribution of Canaan proper. That's going to be the west. And verses 15-32 record the distribution in the Transjordan region. Each of these sections is followed by a phrase, but the tribe of Levi, to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance. That's in verses 14 and 33. The mention of this distinguishing characteristic of the Levites prepares us for chapter 21, where it's going to be explained. So I'm not going to take a lot of time to talk about that today, although I will touch on it a little bit later if we have time. Now, time has passed between chapter 12 and the beginning of chapter 13. Most interpreters think about 7 years has gone by. And then God calls Joshua and the Israelites to action. Perhaps because of the authority associated with Joshua's age and experience, it was important that the allotment of the territories be made by him. He had been Israel's successful military leader in the conquest. Now he has to switch roles and become the diplomat who deals with the complexities of the distribution of the land. And land allotments are going to dominate the rest of the book. In fact, Israel has seen the sufficiency of the Lord to keep his promises time after time throughout their history. So with the promise to fight for Israel at the forefront, God instructs Joshua to begin this process of allotting the land to the different tribes. And this is significant because it marks the beginning of God giving the promised land to the sons of Abraham, one of the three central promises of the Abrahamic covenant. Verse 7 refers to the west of the Jordan River. Of the 12 tribes, two tribes, as we saw, Reuben and Gad, were given land in Transjordan. And also half of the tribe of Manasseh had an allocation on the east side of the river. This leaves 9 tribes plus the other half of Manasseh to receive the west side of the river. And that's what's cited there in verse 7. It says 9 tribes and a half tribe of Manasseh. Now, it's not time to get into a lengthy discussion about the individual tribes. beyond what's written here in the text, I put some information that's supplementary, actually, in your handout that looks at the different ways that the tribes are listed in various parts of the Bible. So I did that so you can have some fun this week poring over the handout, because I know you're going to do that anyway. And you can come back next week and explain to me why you have this list in Genesis and another list in Deuteronomy and some in Joshua and difference in Numbers. I actually gave you a few hints in there, too. I say this because I want it to be a bit of a catalyst for you to think about this. And the catalyst is this, that the confederation of tribes in Israel was a very loosely knit confederation. As Westerners, we look for perfect and absolute consistency. It's just the way we think. And we look for it in just about everything. The Semitic mind didn't work that way. The Semitic peoples didn't demand the same level of consistencies that we do, and this affects how the tribes of Israel are listed and presented in different parts of Scripture. At times, the tribes warred among themselves. They fought each other. Then after Solomon, the united monarchy split. The northern tribes under Jeroboam became a separate kingdom from Judah, a tribe that had sworn allegiance to Solomon's son Rehoboam. Northern tribe fell to Tiglath-Pileser III and Shalmaneser V as a result of attacks that began around 732 BC and went out of existence in 722 when the Assyrians defeated and deported the people. Then the southern kingdom of Judah fell to Nebuchadnezzar II and the Chaldeans in a series of attacks that occurred between 605 and 586 BC. And of course, then we had the great deportation to Babylon. Well, let's look at verse 8 and following. Here's where I need Linda's help. With the other half-tribe, the Reubenites and the Gadites, received their inheritance, which Moses gave them beyond the Jordan to the east, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them, from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, with the city which is in the middle of the valley, and all the plain of Medeba as far as Devon, and all the cities of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, as far as the border of the sons of Ammon, and Gilead, and the territory of the Geshurites and the Maacathites, and all of Mount Hermon, and all of Bashan as far as Selekah, all the kingdom of Og, in Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth and Edrei, he alone was left, the remnant of the Rephaim, for Moses struck them and dispossessed them. But the sons of Israel did not dispossess the Geshurites or the Maacathites, for Geshur and Maacath live among Israel unto this day. So with verse 8, our focus now shifts to Transjordan, the land east of the river, and this is going to be the focus for the rest of the chapter. Verse 8 mentions the other half-tribe, and this, of course, is a reference to Manasseh that will live east of the river. Mike, I know you've got a question.
That doesn't get you river to river. River to river.
No, it doesn't.
The original grant.
That's correct. That's okay. Correct.
Why?
I don't know.
Okay.
So, moving to Transjordan, and these Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh should remind you of what we read in Numbers 32 and also in Joshua 22. So the first tribes to receive their inheritance were the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And this inheritance, this allocation, was in Transjordan, the east side of the river. Now, we have this river. The Jordan River runs north and south, and it divides Transjordan from Canaan proper. Now, obviously, the river was a physical barrier between the tribes in Transjordan and the tribes in Canaan. But it also had the potential to become a cultural and theological barrier, further loosening the brotherly ties between the Transjordanian tribes and their brothers in Canaan. So with this in mind, I want you to notice that in these verses, Moses is mentioned two times in verse 8. Why? Well, we're not going to reread the verses from Numbers that I read at the beginning of the lesson, but I do want to remind you that the allocations in Transjordan were promised to the Reubenites and Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh by Moses. And furthermore, the lands in Transjordan were one when Moses defeated the Amorite coalition headed by Sihon and Og, the military victory that came under his leadership back in Numbers chapter 21. And even more than Joshua, Moses is the unifying figure of Israel because it was he who led the nation out of Egypt at the Exodus and through whom Israel received what we call the Mosaic Law. So by calling the nation's attention to Moses, God is calling for unity among the tribes and suggesting they not allow this river, the River Jordan, to divide them. Now, I want to save verse 14 for later in the lesson and move to verses 15 through 23. So Moses gave an inheritance to the tribes of the son of Reuben according to their families. Their territory was from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, with the city which is in the middle of the valley, and all the plain of Medeba, Heshbon, and all the cities which are on the plain of Devon, and Bemoth Baal, and Beth Baal Maon, and Jahaz, and Kedemoth, and Mephaath, and Kiriathim, and Sema, and Zereth Shahar, on the hill of the valley, and Beth Peor, and the slopes of Pisgah, and Beth Jeshimoth, even all the cities of the plain, and the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses struck with the chiefs of Midian, Eva, Rechem, Zur, Hur, Reba, the princes of Sihon who lived in the land. Sons of Israel also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, the diviner, with the sword among the rest of their slain. The border of the sons of Reuben was the Jordan. This was the inheritance of the sons of Reuben according to their family cities and villages. Well, three locations of these cities that are mentioned in verses 17 to 20 are places where Balaam, several years earlier, had refused to curse Israel and instead had blessed Israel to the great dissatisfaction of Balak, the king of Moab. These are places where the Lord previously had frustrated the intentions of Israel's enemies. And it just so happens now, Reuben's allotment turns out to be the fulfillment of Balaam's prophecy. As we see in verse 22, Israel killed Balaam. And that's an event that's actually recorded back in Numbers chapter 31. Balaam was killed because he played a role in leading Israel to participate in the idolatrous practices of the Canaanites at Beth Peor, the nature of which I described to my dismay, and probably yours too, a few weeks ago. Balaam is an enigma wrapped in conundrum. In Numbers 22:18, he refuses to curse Israel, and he says, "I can't do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of Yahweh, my God." That's a profession of faith in Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. Charles Ryrie deals with this issue of Balaam being a somewhat idolatrous person involved with the occult and professing faith in Yahweh by saying Balaam knew the true God, though he used omens and soothsaying. This is true. Numbers 22, verse 7 indicates that Balak, the king of Moab, hired Balaam because he was a man who engaged in divination. The latter part of that verse reads, "The elders of Midian," those are Balak's guys, "departed with the fees for divination in their hand, and they came to Balaam." This is confirmed in Numbers chapter 24, verse 1, a verse that reads, "Balaam did not go, as at other times, to seek omens." And then in our passage, in Joshua chapter 13, the sons of Israel also killed Balaam. He's called Balaam, the son of Beor, the diviner. The diviner goes with Balaam. Balaam is the diviner. He's the one involved in the occult. And I think he's an example of what happens when a believer integrates or allows to come into our lives satanic beliefs, practices, and anti-God worldviews into what should be a biblical worldview. Balaam is, in a sense, a microcosm of what Israel faced culturally living among the Canaanites. If you take Ephesians 6 seriously, which I do, we face the same challenge today that Israel faced. What is that?
Telephone.
Oh, no, that's all right. That's okay. I thought it was me for a minute. I wasn't sure. So like Israel, we're in a spiritual battle, and we're also in a cultural battle. Now, it's really important not to confuse those two things, and it's important that we get them in the right order. But we can't ignore the elements of our culture that are antithetical to biblical revelation, and for the sake of time, I'll leave it at that, lest we get off topic. Balaam was, at the very least, an imperfect man, as we all are, but his story is a tangible example of the psalmist's promise, "For the wrath of man shall praise you." Verse 23 is the standard Semitic summary statement that appears at the end of a section. This one closes out the discussion of Reuben's allotment. So let's look at verse 24. Moses also gave an inheritance to the tribe of Gad, to the sons of Gad, according to their families. Their territory was Jazer and all the cities of Gilead and half the land of the sons of Ammon as far as Aroer, which is before Rabbah, and from Heshbon as far as Ramoth Mizpah and Betoim, and from Machanaim as far as the border of Debir, and in the valley Beth Haram and Beth Nimrah, Sukkoth and Zaphon, the rest of the kingdom of Sihon, king of Heshbon, with the Jordan as a border as far as the lower end of the Sea of Chinnereth, that's the Sea of Galilee, beyond the Jordan to the east. This is the inheritance of the son of Gad according to their families, cities, and villages. So these verses delineate the territory given to Gad. It includes most of the Jordan Valley east of the river. The southern border of Gad, more or less, is the north shore of the Dead Sea, and the northern border touches the south end of the Sea of Galilee, and then it extends east into what is modern-day Jordan. According to verse 27, Gad's territory encompasses most of the territory that Moses conquered when he defeated Sihon, king of Heshbon, in Numbers chapter 21. So let's look now at verse 29. Moses also gave an inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh. And it was for the half-tribe of the sons of Manasseh according to their families. Their territory was from Machanaim, all Bashan, all the kingdom of Og, the king of Bashan, and all the towns of Jair, which are in Bashan, 60 cities. And also half of Gilead with Ashtaroth and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan, were for the sons of Machir, the sons of Manasseh, for half of the sons of Machir, according to their families. These are the territories which Moses apportioned for an inheritance in the plain of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho to the east. So these describe the territories in the east that were given to the half-tribe of Manasseh. Manasseh, you'll recall, is the eldest son of Joseph. And his younger brother was Ephraim, also son of Joseph. Joseph, you'll remember, gets a double portion of the inheritance of Jacob in Genesis 48:22. This double portion eventually gets split between Ephraim and Manasseh. And so that's why in some of these lists of the tribes, you'll see the tribe of Joseph. In others, you'll see doesn't mention Joseph at all, but it mentions Manasseh and Ephraim, which is a later division of the tribe of Joseph. This is one reason the Bible's lists of the tribes differ. There are some passages that treat it one way, other passages that treat it another. So remember, the tribe of Manasseh is split, half of it on the east, half of it on the west. The southern border of Manasseh stretched from the northern border of Gad past the eastern shore of Galilee into modern-day Syria. It's a very large territory, particularly when you consider that the western allocation for Manasseh stretched all the way to the Mediterranean. So it's a really big area. Verse 30 states that Manasseh occupied all the territory that belonged to Og, the king of Bashan. He's the other Amorite king defeated by Moses immediately after he had the battle with Sihon, king of Heshbon. So through Moses, God had promised Israel the land controlled by these Amorite kings. In the words, "Do not fear him, that is, fear Og, for I have delivered him and all of his people into your hands." So with each of these three eastern allotments, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, there was a clear reminder that the land they now possessed was won for them and given to them by the Lord alone. And finally, in verse 32, we have another summary statement regarding the allocations in Transjordan. Now, I'm going to read those two verses that I didn't read earlier, verse 14 and verse 33, and then I have just a couple of comments on Levi. Verse 14 says, "Only to the tribe of Levi he did not give an inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord, the God of Israel, are their inheritance, as he spoke to him," that is to Levi. Then verse 33, "But to the tribe of Levi Moses did not give an inheritance. The Lord, the God of Israel, is their inheritance, as he had promised to them." So these verses need to be considered together, because from these verses we learn two things. The tribe of Levi did not receive a land inheritance in Canaan or in Transjordan like the other tribes, but Levi does receive an inheritance. It's just a different kind of inheritance from the other tribes. Two things are mentioned. The offerings by fire to the Lord are Levi's inheritance, and the Lord, the God of Israel himself, is Levi's inheritance. Now, at first glance, this may seem like getting a pair of socks for Christmas. Everyone else got land.
The power to tax?
Yeah, Levi doesn't. But when we look at this further and analyze it, nothing could be further from the truth. And I want to look back at Numbers chapter 18 for just a second, starting with verse 20. "Then the Lord said to Aaron, 'You shall have no inheritance in the land, nor own any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the sons of Israel. To the sons of Levi, behold, I have given all the tithe in Israel for an inheritance, in return for their service, which they perform, the service of the tent of meeting. The sons of Israel shall not come near the tent of meeting again, or they will bear the sin and die. Only the Levites shall perform the service of the tent of meeting, and they shall bear their own iniquity.'" What that means is if they fail in some fashion, there will be consequences. "It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and among the sons of Israel they shall have no inheritance. For the tithes of the sons of Israel, which they offer as an offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites for an inheritance. Therefore I have said concerning them, they shall have no inheritance among the sons of Israel." So Joshua chapter 13, verses 14 and 33 was not new information. Aaron had been told while they were in the wilderness that the tribe of Levi, the tribe that descends from him — I put a chart on the back of your handout that's kind of complicated, but you kind of see how where the Levites come from, but they come from Aaron. What's promised to them is that they're going to get something better. They're going to get something better than a tract of land. To understand this, keep in mind the economy of ancient Israel was agrarian. A Jewish family either raised crops or animals, sheep or cattle, for income. So a land grant meant income for a family. The Levites, however, get their income directly from their service to the Lord in the tabernacle. They receive a portion of the tithes and the offerings the other families paid for from their income off the land. So if we — what I think is I want to do at this point, I did a couple of word studies just in my own preparation, and I took some of that information and put it in your handout. I want to look at two terms that are important in the broader context of the conquest. Now, expanding a little bit beyond this issue with the Levites, but if we understand what these two terms mean, it will help us to understand what's going on with the Levites. So there are two words that have application to the conquest. When they're used together, they convey the idea of driving out the indigenous Canaanites, with the result that Israel inherits the land. The two terms are Yarosh and Nahal. Now, I should apologize for what I'm about to do. I need to explain something about Hebrew words, how Hebrew verbs were written. So just bear with me a minute. Hebrew has seven primary verb stems. I'll explain this. It has a couple of others that are rarely used, but seven primary ones. A verb as a part of speech expresses action or state of being. A stem indicates what kind of action is being described by the verb. If the verb is active or passive, it tells something about the intensity of the action of the verb. And in some cases, writing a verb in one stem or another, and these are physically different ways of writing. Writing in one stem or another can change the meaning of a verb quite significantly. So let's think about this word yarosh. And you've got some of this in your handout. The verb yarosh occurs 230 times in the Old Testament. Most of these occurrences appear in Deuteronomy, where it appears 70 times, and Joshua, where it appears 30 times. In the kal stem, the kal is the most basic way to write a Hebrew verb. Yarash usually is translated to inherit or to possess, and it's used this way frequently in the context of Israel inheriting the land of Canaan. And this is the case throughout the entire narrative of the conquest. So when written in the kal stem, the one inheriting or possessing the land is Israel. In the kal, the meaning of Yarash involves the legal inheritance or transfer of family leadership, family property, or in the case of the conquest, the transfer of territory from the Canaanites to Israel. This inheritance sometimes is passively received, but more commonly, where it is used to refer to territory, it's something that is taken. So it's a little different from our use of the idea of inheriting something. When a population is dispossessed, their territory becomes that which their conquerors inherit. Now, another stem that you find commonly in Hebrew is called the hifil stem. In the hifil stem, it's normally causal. For example, if I write the Hebrew word bow, which is a verb in the kal stem, it means to go. But if I write it in the hifil, it means to cause to go. It's causal. Or better, to send. So I can take this verb, bow, put it in the kal and it means to go. Or I can put it in the hifil and it means to send. It changes the meaning of the verb. In the hifil, yarash, instead of meaning to inherit, usually is translated to drive out or dispossess. So it shifts the meaning from receiving the land as an inheritance to stressing the act of driving out the Canaanite tribes. The causal element of the hifil is seen if we think of driving out as causing to possess or causing to inherit. When yarash is written in the hifil, the subject of the verb is almost always God. He is the one dispossessing and driving out the Canaanites on behalf of Israel. Now, there's a verse that is particularly good at expressing this, and it's in Deuteronomy chapter 9. It's verses 4 and 5. Listen to this. Do not say in your heart, when the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it's because of my righteousness the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. That's Yarash and the kal, to possess. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is dispossessing Yarash in the hifil. He's dispossessing them before you. It's not for your righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart that you're going to possess. There's the kal. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God is driving them out, same word, yarash in the hifil, before you in order to confirm the oath which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now here's the point of this little Hebrew lesson. The interaction of the Cal and the Hifil stems in this passage in Deuteronomy is, to me, is fascinating because it perfectly underscores the relationship between the two roles of the Lord and Israel by simply altering the way a verb is formed in the Hebrew language. It's the divine and the human, side by side, distinguished only by the form of a single Hebrew verb. It's the same word in each instance, but the verb stem changes the focus from Israel's inheriting the land of Canaan as a grace gift and the divine act of driving out Israel's enemies by the Lord himself so that Israel can then inherit what God has promised and is providing. The second word is Nahal. It's closely related in meaning to Yarash. It means something like take as a possession. In particular, it's used to possess land. And there's a very interesting noun that derives from Nahal. It's Nahalah. It means inheritance. Nahalah has three shades of meaning, each one involving ownership. It can refer to land owned by individuals, families, or tribes. But at another time, it also asserts that God owns Israel. There are occasions when Israel is called Yahweh's Nahalah, Yahweh's inheritance. But God didn't inherit Israel as we use the term inheritance because he always owned it. Usually this idea of ownership is used to distinguish God's relationship to Israel from the Canaanite concept of viewing the pagan gods as localized deities. But then, the third shade of meaning here is the idea of Israel as Yahweh's inheritance being reversed in some texts so that Yahweh becomes Israel's inheritance, and specifically Levi's inheritance. Numbers 18:21, Deuteronomy 18:1, and Joshua 13:14 and 33. This is particularly helpful in understanding these verses in Joshua. Bruce Waukee comments on this. He wrote, "The inheritance of the Levites shows that an inheritance without land is possible. The Levites live on Israel's tithes and offerings to Yahweh. In this way, they share the closest fellowship with Yahweh, and their inheritance is reckoned as Yahweh himself. In fact, intimate fellowship with him is the best inheritance of all, and it is available to all who desire it." And then he goes on to quote, or to cite, Psalm 16:5, Psalm 119:57, and Psalm 142, verse 5, as examples. Now, I just have a couple of concluding comments. Though the 12 tribes are separated physically by the Jordan River, they share a theological and historical unity that transcends geography. In times of war, they fight together. In times of peace, they worship together and they serve the same God. They have a common history. They have a common faith that's grounded in the same Mosaic law that was given by God to Israel. And this law is the same for every tribe. The conquest is frustrating because many times Israel won only partial victories. God promised in Joshua 13:6 to drive out Israel's enemies. But because of incomplete obedience on Israel's part, this never happened in full. The closest Israel came to complete control of Canaan was during the kingships of David and Solomon. Every gift from God is a grace gift because God's favor can't be earned. But there are rewards for obedience. The reward for Israel's obedience was peace and prosperity in the promised land. Therefore, the recurring theme in this book is the Lord's call for obedience. When Israel responds to the Lord in faith, there's victory. When Israel is unfaithful, there's defeat. Obedience under grace presupposes a covenant bond grounded in election, God's sovereign choice to bless Israel solely because it pleases him to do so. The defeat of the Canaanites is a necessary precursor to possessing the promised land. But it was not on the basis, it was not inherited on the basis of Israel's righteousness, but as a result of God's sovereign election of Israel. And the conquest included the exacting of divine justice on a culture that had gone over the line morally and failed to accept the forgiveness that always was available to them. As we've seen, a key term appears in this chapter, the word inheritance. Inheritance presumes a relationship. Strangers are not heirs. Family members are heirs. Israel is the heir of God's promises because the nation has a unique covenant relationship with God, not unlike the relationship that we have as husband and wife. And the tangible, observable proof of this covenant relationship is the land. The land is God's land, promised to his son Israel as a gift that flows from his grace. But as important as the land itself is, it's the relationship between the nation and Yahweh that is the true value of Israel's inheritance. The church also enjoys a covenant relationship with God. It's through the new covenant, ratified by Jesus himself with Israel at the Last Supper, the night of his arrest. The new covenant was given to and ratified with Israel. But we receive blessings that overflow from the new covenant to us because we have been grafted into the benefits of that covenant by the grace of God. And I want to close today. My goodness, it's going to be exactly on time. By reading a few verses from 1 Peter chapter 2. Therefore, putting aside all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn babes, long for the pure milk, that means pure doctrine of the word, so that by it you may grow in respect to salvation, if you have tasted the kindness of the Lord. And coming to him as to a living stone, which has been rejected by men, but is choice and precious in the sight of God, you also as living stones are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. As a community of priests, we share a similar but even better inheritance than the Levites, because like them, our inheritance is not a piece of land, but it is a relationship with God through Jesus Christ.